Hello, and welcome to the first series of the King's Talks. The environment and our human impact on it has become a prominent topic in recent years. Through our growing population, exploration, and desire to improve our lives, humanity has affected everything from global temperatures to water, light, air, and soil quality. Here to discuss this topic with me are Paul Klawn, environmental manager currently working for a power distribution company, and Nicole Martinson, geographer and assistant head teacher at the King's School. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Paul, would you start us off, please, by talking to us about the way environmental awareness and attitudes have changed over the years?
Yeah, sure. As again, a lot of people think, Greta Thunberg and various other people have invented environmental controls. Well, that's quite clearly not the case. Environmental controls or legislation have been around for a long time. Before they had any real impact, they have taken some time to develop into what we have in place now. I mean, we can look back to as early as 17th century when Charles II commissioned a study on air pollution because he was looking at the effects of coal burning and how it was impacting on human life. Early stages of the industrial development were bringing those problems to the populace. And of course, everybody then became aware of it, but didn't think they could do anything about it. So you just look at the way things have developed over the years, and then the next probably key element of that was in Victorian times. The year 1858 was key. In London, they had what they referred to as the Great Stink. Now, it's a lovely name, and yes, it was caused by sewage and effluent from businesses, from factories, from humans living alongside the river, discharging into the River Thames and turning it into a dead, effluent-filled watercourse, which is very hard to imagine against a watercourse now that has salmon running in it, which gives you an indication perhaps of where we've got to in terms of environmental controls. The river was so bad, it led to the evacuation of Parliament, so that the Parliament was cleared of people for their own health. Following that, they developed a commissioner on sewers and decided that they would close out all the cesspits, all those foul things that were discharging into the river, and make it stop. Well, people just found other ways of putting it back into the rivers, or it just caused more problems because there was nowhere for it to go. So following that, they then passed an act to build the London sewage system. All of us have seen pictures and illustrations of the massive cavernous systems there are in a city like London. Now, that's replicated in all our major cities and then on a much smaller scale in all the other towns and villages. But the local authorities were then obliged by the early 1900s, they were obliged to start building sewage treatment plants that were fit for purpose, that could take the flows of the planned populations for the areas and treat it to a standard that was acceptable to be put back into the watercourses and rivers. So we got a whole new vestige of control over what was happening to our watercourses. At the same time, air pollution was rambling on as being a continued problem. And even in the early, again, in the early eight, in the mid to late 1800s and into 1900s, the Alkalis Act, a new piece of legislation was written specifically to look at the control of gaseous acidic discharges that were occurring because of industry producing alkalis. And the resultant waste from that was discharged straight into the atmosphere to add to your smog, to your coal burning, and generate the first implications of what we now or often refer to still, but was christened then as acid rain. Now, the acid rain was causing health problems. The air pollution was causing health problems. So something had to happen, and the inspectorate, the alkali inspectorate was born. So the first pollution team, if you will, pollution control team were out there. By the time we got into the 30s, we were looking at trade effluent control. We've got the sewers in place. We've got the sewage treatment works in place. Now, sewage works function on biology. They're a living organism. It might not look to it to most, but the thing that works in there, it's down to the bacteria that are in there. And it's all about biology. So what was happening was trade effluents, factory discharges, and effluent being a liquid waste from any of these businesses, be it a chemical works or even down to a laundrette, any liquid waste is going down the sewer and it's ending up at sewage works. And if you don't control what you're receiving at the sewage works, it kills things. And I've myself, in my past work, I've seen sewage works severely impacted by nighttime discharges from factories where the concentration of chemicals and things that was in it can be managed during the day, but if it goes down at night, then you've got a problem and it can wipe out a sewage works and it can give you a serious problem for 1 or 2 months while it gets reborn again and is capable of treating sewage and removing the important things like the biological, the organic side of it that keeps it, you know, makes it clean at the other end. I wouldn't say it's drinking water, but it's clean. So that started the whole process of consents and licensing, and also controls by the way of fines that were payable by these people, and also charges for having the service to have the treated waste taken away. So the organization that was then monitoring that was coming under the water authorities, or sorry, the water companies at the time, who were at the time small utilities companies that were gradually growing and taking over each other. So there was a lot of movement in the whole infrastructure, if you will, that controls as pollution. Through into the 50s, you've got smogs developing in London and major health risks. They reckon there was 4,000 additional deaths in that year through the cause of a 5-day smog, when it just was impossible to see and drive in London because the fog descended on the whole city just because of coal burning and industrial discharges basically to air. So a lot of the local authorities have followed suit. Air quality monitoring is the norm now in all our major cities. Again, we all hear about the impacts of cars and vehicles and diesel and everything else and how we've got to address this. So there's a whole legislative background going on there between the local authorities, primarily in charge of that one, but nothing that we can't avoid in anything we do. We all have our impact. Even when we burn our logs on the log burner at home, yes, we're having our impacts. The 70s, 80s, 90s then took us through a whole series of more directed pollution control legislation that was taking its guide from what other countries had maybe done, and certainly some countries were running ahead of us. The Dutch were very good at developing a lot of their early pollution on water because they were so reliant on the canals and everything through Holland that they were very much leaders in the field of contaminated land and also water. Using that as a framework, legislation was developed throughout the UK to look at air, noise, waste, water, all the different types of media where we can visualize pollution as such. So we can't think about it as in its individual elements, because for instance, with a power station, if you put scrubbers on the chimneys that are taking the waste into the air, great, you stop the gaseous emission, it turn it into a liquid. And the liquid then has to be taken away to a treatment plant to be treated. So it's a very convoluted controls. So we've got through to the 2000s, and suddenly climate change was on us. Sustainability came about. I think the first time sustainability was mentioned was back in 87. There was a government paper written, Our Common Inheritance. And it was that was the first one that referred to the need for sustainable development. And Nicole will know from her students, etc., there's a whole area of work to be done on sustainable development. And it's a very interesting way of looking at everything we do should be mindful of the impact it's having on the environment proper. In terms of regulatory controls, we've moved on to firmer controls now through, through things like even through the Town and Country Planning Act, so that every individual development has to submit planning. And we all hear of planning, you know, planning commission and everything else. The bigger the project, the more complicated that requirement. And in fact, working through things like nationally significant infrastructure projects, which is a big mouthful, NSIPs, that would cover things like major power stations, offshore wind farms, onshore wind farms, anything of size and scale that is going to have an environmental impact by its very nature. They then fall under a different piece of stronger legislation called the Development Consent Ordinance, Development Control Ordinance, or the DCO, which HS2, who I will mention on later, but I'm working on that project at the moment, and they have had to develop their own act by working with the local authorities and with the Parliament to actually sanction the development of their own act, which encompasses all those controls and more, which is allowing them to build the project, but also very mindful of the fact that that impact, that project must be controlled. Finally, I suppose the last piece of that now would be the environmental impact assessment, which is, again, a legislative ordinance that is in place to control all these impacts. This will provide an environmental statement of all our big projects. And these are the sort of things I work with as an environmental manager to control all impacts to the environment. And that is social, economic, archaeological, cultural, visual, as well as environmental. And environmental will also cover everything from waste, water, air, noise, traffic, you name it. It's under control. So we're in a much better place than we were a few years ago.
Thank you very much for that whistle-stop tour. So, Nicole, moving on to something more specific, we hear a lot in the news, and certainly over the last 10 years, about carbon emissions and climate change. Paul's already referred to that. But more recently, in Britain in particular, flooding has become a phenomenon. Would you talk us through what has caused that? Why has this become such a big problem in recent years?
Yeah, flooding for me, it's something that's quite personal because of where I live, not where my actual house is. I live in South Yorkshire. My house is not in a flood zone, deliberately chosen. However, I do live really close to the River Don, and I've worked in Sheffield in the past, and the River Don is a river that has experienced significant flooding, like many rivers in the UK. Particular event that I would like to talk about is 2007, which I know is probably before many of our listeners may have been born, or they may be very small at the time. In 2007, we had the wettest May to July on record. I say 2007, that was the wettest on record. We have had more wetter months since then. June 2012 was the wettest June on record in 2012. Then we've had 2020. Now, 2020 was a year that we remember for COVID. And because of COVID, it really went under the radar that 2020 was the year that was the top 10 for having the most sunshine and the most rain. So it's really easy to forget that because of everything that was going on, quite rightly, because we did have a pandemic happening and there were other things that were, you know, taking the spotlight in the news. In January, we had major flooding in the UK. This is one of those things that is continuing to happen. And we are putting lots of measures in place to, you know, try and mitigate against that. However, we are having significant flood events still. So in 2007, going back, we had a storm, Storm Uriah. On top of that, we've had weeks and weeks of rain. And some places on, well, round about that time, in times of Storm Uriah, we had like 140 millimetres of rain falling in a day. That's 14 centimetres in a day that was falling in one flood event. storm event. Now, what happened was I was leaving work on the 25th of June and in Sheffield, and I found out that the River Don had burst its banks because of this flood event. What followed after that was probably the most worrying drive home I've ever had, and I've driven through snow and all sorts of things, because what happened was I was driving home and every single road that I was trying to get down was filled with water. There was gridlock traffic absolutely everywhere, and then what you had was you got to where you thought you could get to and it was flooded and your car could not possibly have gone through it. So you would turn around and go back again somewhere else and find that was flooded as well. I did eventually get to home, you'd be pleased to know. There's areas like Tinsley, which is an area of Sheffield, which is really close to the River Don. The river looked like it had gone into the streets. The streets looked like rivers. The water was that high. There were wheelie bins being taken down the street. There was a plant, you know, just off it went. There was like cars literally floating down the street. We're talking severe flood event. Now, when I got home, like I said, it was worse than, you know, from what my experience was. We found out the Meadowhall shopping centre, huge shopping centre in Sheffield, the bottom floor was flooded. We found out that Hillsborough Football Stadium, if you're Sheffield Wednesday fan, which I'm sure somebody might be, we found out that that was filled with water as well, 6 foot of water in the stadium. And unfortunately, there was a really sad case where a boy lost his life. He was swept away in the floodwaters at Millhouses Park, which was obviously one of the, you know, most horrible impacts of what happened. So why did this happen? Now, going on from what Paul said, some of it is to do with like the sewage system, I'll talk about it in a minute, and also climate change. So climate change, as we know, global temperatures have been increasing over the last few decades quite significantly. We are, in the UK, there's no evidence at the moment we're getting more frequent storms. We're still getting the same number of storms at the moment. However, what is happening, we are seeing that our storm intensity is getting stronger, which what that means is the winds, especially close to the surface, are getting stronger and stronger. Now, we've kind of known that this is a thing that's affecting other countries. We know about Bangladesh, for example. We know that Bangladesh floods really frequently. They're impacted by tropical storms going through the Bay of Bengal. The water temperature's increasing. They're getting more intense storms. This is also happening in the UK. Our storms are also getting more intense, which means that we are going to get more intense floods. This was 2007, we had Storm Uriah. You may remember Storm Dennis, which I think was 2019, huge storm. So we are getting really intense storms in the UK. So that's one of the things. Climate change, but also it's what we're doing, what we are doing to our built environment. So Paul mentioned the sewers before. So we've got these sewers, which are great. They take away all the things that we don't really want to look at, and they go down the toilet or down the sink, and they end up being taken away in these huge sewers, which then go and get treated. Now, these sewers are not, in some places, that nice smooth tunnel of water being taken away because we have filled them with things that shouldn't be there. So you may remember the Fatberg that was in London a couple of years ago that was the size of a double-decker bus, and people had to use huge drills and heavy machinery to break this up to try and get it out of the sewers. So what's happening is we are throwing fats and things down the drain. We are emptying our frying pan down the drain, and that will then congeal in the sewer and mixed in with all other things that have gone down the drains, things that may have been flushed down the toilet that shouldn't have been flushed down the toilet, things that have gone down the drains, crisp packets. There are all sorts of things in our sewers that is now blocking up that wonderful pipe network that we have got that takes all that water away. And as soon as you are blocking something up, when it rains, there is nowhere for that rainwater to go except for back out of those drains. And we end up with our streets being flooded with horrible effluents and things that we really don't want to be swimming around in when it floods. There's a village near me, they are nowhere near a river. And what happened was there was a huge storm event, and because the drains and the sewers were filled, what happened was all this water came out and flooded huge numbers of houses. Millions of damage to all this village, just completely taken out by this water, where it could have been easily avoidable by not putting things in the sewers that you shouldn't, and clearing them out as well. So that's one thing. There's another way that we affect our built environment, we build on floodplains. Floodplains are naturally flat areas of land next to rivers. They are created by rivers flooding. That's why they're called floodplains. Now, floodplains are great because they are flat and therefore you can easily build on them. It's a great place to put your house. It's much easier than building on the mountain. So people build there thinking, well, it only floods once in every 200 years. However, as we know, we are getting more intense storms and these areas are getting flooded. But it's not just because of the storms. It's also because we are putting concrete on our wonderful absorbent surfaces that are naturally soaking up our water. So if you have got a field, you have got plants, you've got soil, you've got grass, you've got trees taking in that water, and you cover that with concrete, which is impermeable, which means that water cannot sink into it, what that means is the water has to go somewhere. So what it does, it runs off the concrete much quicker than it would normally, and it ends up going into our sewers, which are already, as I've just mentioned, filled. We are also very, very quickly going into rivers. Now, rivers cannot cope with water entering them faster than normal, and also cannot cope if you have also filled those full of things that you shouldn't have filled in them. When I used to walk down the River Don years ago, it's not like this anymore. There were things you could see, shopping trolleys sticking out of it. You could see rubbish. People had thrown things in it. There was fly tipping. Now, that is where people sometimes are a little bit lazy, don't want to take stuff to the tip, and they throw it in the river. It's not like it is cleared regularly now. It doesn't look like that. That didn't help in 2007, though, that there were things in there taking up the space that water should be able to flow down. Rivers naturally silt up as well. You will get mud forming in the bottom of rivers as well. And that all takes away from that space where the water could go. So these are reasons why we've got flooding happening. So there are things we can do about it. So, for example, they've spent millions already in Sheffield on the Don. They've spent millions doing all sorts of things like clearing out those rivers, making sure that there's no blockages, that the water can flow freely, making sure they're deep enough and the banks are high enough to they can control the water if we do get flood events. As I've said, we have had more rain in a month, since 2007. So we have had wetter periods and it has been much more effective. So the work that we're doing has been pretty good. It's been effective because we can mitigate. Other things that have been done, things such as planning where it can flood. So if you can do a neighbourhood floodplain, which is one neighbourhood that will be flooded, that isn't going to have an impact on housing or businesses or loss of life, flood that on purpose and then save the other areas. So that's one thing we can do. But my biggest thing that I'm a big, and in my students who listen to this, they will know I'm a big fan of this, which is green infrastructure, which is joining up our areas with green areas. So having like these pathways of greenery through a city, joining a park up with other green areas. So parks, great areas for absorbing lots and lots of water. It's not concrete. It will sink in. It takes away a lot of that flood risk. If you're planting trees as well, they're taking up the water. And it's something called SUDS, which is nothing to do with bubbles or anything like that. SUDS is where you've got your urban drainage systems. And that is where you are trying to reduce the risk of that excess water from the concrete having an impact on the rivers. So good example of what they've done in our local area is a car park, when it was built, instead of just leaving it as grass where the water goes on it and it would get churned up by, car wheels, however, the floodwater would go in, what happened was they reinforced the grass. So the car park was a grass car park but reinforced with a grid. And that grid didn't get the car wheels chewing it up. However, what could happen was the grass could grow through it. So there are things we can do. There are sustainable management strategies that we can put into place. And from my perspective, I think that's really something where we should be going in the future.
Thank you very much. So we've heard about how humanity has caused issues in the environment, but also how we're trying to turn that around. Paul, would you anchor this even more specifically in the HS2 projects, please? What is that project or those projects needing to do to make sure that they're not adversely impacting the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working currently with one of the electricity providers, so we're working well ahead of the actual project. The construction of the rail system itself is scheduled for completion by 2029, 2033. It's almost inconceivable to think that far ahead, but the works that are ongoing now are what they refer to as the early works. which is clearing the corridor through, basically, to allow the build itself to go ahead in due course. Now, in doing so, the whole area of the HS2 project, and anybody that is sufficiently interested, I'd refer them to the internet and just look for HS2, because on the government site, there is a whole ream of all the documentation, and certainly anybody that's interested in the environmental work that has been done to protect the environment in terms of the HS2 impacts. There's a lot of documents there, which I certainly refer you to. Now, I know as a consultant or as a contractor working for HS2 as a client, because it is an entity as such now, that the restrictions that are placed on all their work contracts are very, very stringent on environmental protection. Some of these, we're looking at the moment at 140 miles of the phase one of HS2, which is the London Euston up to Birmingham sections. But within that section, we've got, for instance, there's 32 miles of drilled tunnels. So we're talking about water and impacts. You've got to also understand that drilling below ground, you're going to be working into natural aquifers, and an aquifer being the permeable ground that basically holds water, so that, like you have on the beach, you dig a hole in the beach and it fills with water at the bottom because you've got water underneath the solids. So if you imagine that, but on the scale of something the size of a train track, it's a sizable train. It's like the cross-channel tunnels, things like that, because it's being drilled like that, we're going through. So there's a lot of measures in place to protect both the existing aquifers, so that would be the water that's in that land. And studies will have been taken place well before this, with boreholes being placed into the ground to look at the groundwater levels, to assess what level of work and protection they need to do, because you can drill a tunnel, but nature will take that tunnel back if it can. So water will pour into that tunnel. So you have to grout the outside of it, basically, or the inside of it, which means you're going to see the water from coming into the railway, because nobody would want to be taking the train through the same flood water that Nicole got through in Sheffield. So wouldn't be a good idea. So it has to be dry, has to be provision for pumping, things like this. So there are measures that have to go into place to look at the water environment that you're impacting on. For every culvert that you build, every cutting that you take. So if you've got an uneven surface, the railway line needs to be as flat as possible. So if you've got rising ground, you're going to be cutting into it for the width of the railway track. And that spoil, that material that you're taking out of there, is then going to be migrated to other parts of the project where they've got to actually build embankments to get over motorways and things like this. So there's bridges, there's 38 miles of bridges. And so yeah, it's phenomenal, the amount of activity to minimize the impact on the natural environment that's going on. With the water, that's just one aspect of it. There are water courses to be crossed. There are water courses to be crossed by our cables. So if we approach a water course and we want to put a cable, instead of going over the river, we're going to have to go under the river. Now, sounds like an interesting concept, but it is a drilling operation that then takes the cable ducts, the pipe that we put the cable in, they drill that underneath the river and appear out the other side of the river. And we can then put our cable down through that tube and bring it out the other end. So they'll do multiple drills under a water course, and I'm talking 6-7 meters sometimes underneath the riverbed. That way we don't impact on the water course. We leave it as its natural green corridor, connecting up the same thing as Nicole was referring to, the green corridors. The river corridors are essential, and the vegetation alongside them. If you're going to dig all that out and disturb it, then you're losing continuity, and we're avoiding that wherever possible. Ecologically, you're doing the same sort of measures. So you could have things like natural woodlands, ancient woodlands that have been there for many, many years. Instead of digging through them and taking the trees out, we're actually going underneath the woodland and coming out the other side, maybe half a mile away. So measures are being put in place, and that drilling itself is potentially impacting on both flood risk and on the underlying waters that we rely on. So again, all prescribed, all controlled by companies like the EA, who have a lot to say in this matter. So much so with the project that we've got two dedicated environmental agency staff that work for HS2 simply to deal with all the applications that we've got. it's reassuring, I think, to see the level of protection that is going into something as controversial, let's say, as the HS2 project. And I think that, you know, with the legislation we've got behind us that I referred to before, and the wherewithal will never satisfy everybody, but ultimately it's to deliver a railway that is to control things like carbon. And I mean, it's a lower carbon option. For instance, I think the stats say something like 17 times less carbon in taking the train journey from Birmingham to London than taking a flight down from Birmingham to London that a lot of business people will do. Even in terms of a car journey, it's 7 times less carbon emissions than taking it down by car, by using the train instead. So we've got to look at the benefits. We've got to look at the offsets. We've got to look at the things that are placed on us as a developer to actually make it happen in an environmentally friendly way. And that's one of the key roles of myself and people I work with as an environmental manager.
Thank you ever so much. Thank you to Nicole and to Paul for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed the programme.